We will start this day by discussing, reading and discussing one psalm. This is Psalm 27. It is generally called the Psalm of the Sanctuary. And it is going to be an introductory presentation before we get into the more difficult, theologically difficult issues. So, before I get into Psalm 27, let me ask you the following question. If you had only one request to the Lord, one single request that you would like to ask the Lord, what would it be? Here is the elder of the church, one of the elders. Yes.
Come back soon.
Yes. Yes.
Save me and my family.
Very good, yes.
We have a sermon on this last week. Video baptism.
Okay.
Open my eyes.
Yeah, yes.
That's similar to mine. For a closer walk with God.
For a closer walk with God. Yes. So all these requests are very, very good. Let's see what was David's single request. He says, Psalm 27, he says, verse 4, "One thing I ask of the Lord, this is what I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple." Very interesting. It may be a little bit but he says, only one thing I ask from the Lord, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord, in his temple, in the sanctuary, all the days of my life. And of course we may wonder why he's asking this. When he wrote this psalm, he was the fugitive. He was hiding from King Saul in the caves of the Judean desert. And we may also conclude that maybe he was in a state of distress. He was, fearing for his life, and the sanctuary was in the vicinity of Jerusalem. So in that sense, maybe he was looking for security. But I don't think this is the case. We will see a little bit later that David, throughout his life, he somehow kept this desire in his heart. One thing I ask from the Lord, that I may dwell in his temple, in the sanctuary, all the days of my life. And once, when he came out from these caves and he became the king, he did not forget for this request. And you remember that one day he invited the court prophet, we may call him court prophet, Nathan. And what did he say to Nathan? "I would like to build sanctuary." And what did Nathan said? At the beginning he said, "Go and build." But when the Lord talked to him later, he said, "No, your hands are full of blood. You cannot build. Your son is going to build the sanctuary." But David says, "If I cannot build the sanctuary, I'm going to collect materials. I'm going to collect stones, wood. And then for the church, there is a need for musicians. And I will assemble musicians, and I will." We also know for sure that David invented one instrument, and there are hymns that are needed to be sang in the church. So he wrote hymns. Do you know that out of 150 psalms, David wrote 99 psalms, and these psalms have been sang in the church, in the worship service. So David says, "If I cannot build the sanctuary to the Lord, I'm going to do everything I can." so that the sanctuary can function and progress. So there are many questions in the Seventh Adventist Church asked whether the sanctuary is something that is important. Let me just tell you some. We are discussing this very often in different meetings, and I would like you. I also had different experiences during my pastoral ministry. I remember one lady. She was a lawyer. I was giving barrister. I was giving her Bible studies, and at one point she told me, "Please, I like the Bible." But when it comes to the sanctuary, all this blood in the morning and in the evening, and so on and so on. It was a little bit too much for her. But let me tell you how the things are in the Bible. Only in Pentateuch, there are 45 whole chapters dedicated to the sanctuary. 45, right? But this is not only in Pentateuch. If we go to the prophets, big prop from Isaiah and so on, there are another 45 chapters dedicated to the sanctuary. And then if we go to the Psalms, do you know that almost all Psalms have sanctuary terminology? Maybe you are not aware of this, but this is, you know, they constantly speak about the sanctuary. If we go to the book of Revelation, do you know that every major section of the book of Revelation starts with the sanctuary scene? You know, some of them, like candlesticks and all. There is constantly sanctuary terminology. The Gospels portrayed Jesus as the fulfillment of the Old Testament sacrifices. And if we go to Peter and Paul, they also constantly are making allusions to the sanctuary. So there have been theologians in our church and outside who were looking a theme which permeates the whole of the Bible, the common theme, and probably no other topic in the Bible is so present as the doctrine of the sanctuary, whether we like it or not. So this, at the beginning of this day, I just would like you to be aware that this is there in the Bible, present from the beginning to the end. And we cannot just make it, and our pioneers recognize that. I have here a quote from Ellen White. Listen what she says. This is in Great Controversy, page 424. She says, "The subject of the sanctuary was the key which unlocked the mystery of disappointment in 1844. It opened to view a complete system of truth, connected, inharmonious, showing that God's hand had directed the great Advent movement and revealing present duty as it brought to light the position and work of his people." So it is interesting that Ellen White says that the doctrine of the sanctuary is the key. And then there is another interesting statement. It opened the view of the complete system of truth. You know, pardon me? This is Great Controversy, chapter 24. And this is the page 423. Yes. And you know, it is, this term system is used in philosophy and in theology also. When we are speaking about the system, let's think that system is something like this, for example. If this is the system, within that system there are different doctrines or teachings or philosophical views. But if these different teachings are to make system, then there has to be harmony among them. You understand? This is what makes them system. And every system has its starting point, generally we say. And this starting point is going to determine in many ways, I have to lift it? Oh, I apologize. You are right. Is it better now?
Lights on, Andy.
Yes. One.
Okay.
Is it now? Yes.
Nothing to do with you.
No, but I haven't. But I did not press that button. Yeah. Okay. So if it is system, then there is always the starting point of the system. And this starting point, this is the basic assumption, as we usually say in the doctoral dissertation of math. It determines also the rest of the system. So let me give you an example, for example. Do you know what is the starting point of Luther's theology, of his theological system? Any guess? It would be difficult, for example, for you. This is what we would think, but it is not. It is the Lord's Supper, for example. Because it was debated with the Catholic Church. Because Catholic Church, they believe in sacrament, and the grace is infused through the sacraments. And Luther was, and they were withdrawing the wine, from laity, only the priests. So he wrote his pamphlet, the Babylonian Captivity of the Church. And for him, it was, he even fought the war, literal war with Zwingli, concerning the Lord's Supper. It was so important for the reformers. So if we go into the theology of Martin Luther, we will see that this is one of the key starting points. And this starting point is going to determine other also points in his theological system. He was differing from John Calvin on this. They disagree on the so-called communicatio idiomatum. It meant they have been discussing Luther. He rejected the Catholic view of the Lord's Supper, which is called transubstantiation. So you know that they believe that at the point when the priest blesses the hostia or the bread, it transforms itself into the real body. And this is not, when we think real, we think that it remains. No, they believe, I've seen, Notre Dame is very close to Andrews, you know. I've been several, this is the largest Catholic university in the world, in Michigan, very close to it. And I've been there many times studying in their library, and many times I've seen pictures taken, especially in Philippines, when the priest puts the piece of bread on the tongue, then suddenly, after the blessing of the priest, there are blood vessels, and it transforms itself into the piece of meat. It is real, and they are proud of this. You would be, you know, we would be. They believe it is a miracle. So it is interesting. So Luther rejected this view of transubstantiation, but he also was struggling with the concept of. He was struggling when he says, "But Jesus said, this is my body." In Latin, it is hoc est corpus meum. So Luther said, what does it mean, this is my body? But then Luther was very practical. He said, but Jesus is sitting in the right hand of God. How he can be present there and physically present in the hostia? Yes. And then he was struggling with that. But then he developed the view, the so-called communicatio idiomatum. And this lady, she knows Latin. He believed that Jesus can communicate his characteristics to the... So finally Luther finished with believing that Jesus is mystically present in the bread. We don't know how, but he is, because he says, hoc est corpus meum, this is my body. And so this is in the system of Saint Augustine, for example, the starting point is the concept of sin. Sin, you remember, because he was very much concerned. So Ellen White says in the Seventh-day Adventist theological system, the key, the starting point was the doctrine of the sanctuary. And it determined in many ways many other things in our understanding of ecclesiology, soteriology, hamartiology, and so on and so on. Okay, this is just was a short digression just to explain the system and why we believe that the doctrine of the sanctuary. But then people are saying, okay, we say that sanctuary is the key of our theological system. But where is Jesus? Why we are emphasizing sanctuary and we are not saying that Jesus is the center of our... Yes, Jesus is at the very center of the sanctuary. When I think we made a huge mistake, and this is the first important point this morning that I would like to make. For many years, we have been discussing the question of building. Emphasis, but the sanctuary is not primarily the building. Yes, it is building, but it is not primary. It is what Jesus is doing for us in the sanctuary. So then don't, I still remember Gerhard Hazel, I think Lou probably knows him, one of our greatest theologians, and he died a few years ago in the accident. Yes, we were together. And he was teasing us in the class. He would say, of what materials is made heavenly sanctuary? And then we would say gold, silver, and blah, blah, blah. And he said, no, no. Heavenly sanctuary is made of heavenly stuff. So we should not emphasize the building stuff. So the sanctuary is primarily what Jesus is doing for us. Jesus is at the center of the sanctuary. And when we say this, then we say, yes, the sanctuary is the key for understanding all our doctrines. And you will see the sanctuary is primarily an experience. When David says, one thing I ask from the Lord, that I may dwell all the days of my life, he's talking primarily of an experience, not of the ritual. What experience? There is a triple experience that David is talking about in Psalm 27. So please, whenever in the future you come to the church, just remember why it was the single-minded request from David to dwell all the days of his life in the sanctuary of the Lord. Let's see. Let's read again Psalm 27 verse 4. One thing I ask of the Lord. This is what I seek. That I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. Why? Why? The first experience that David was willing to have in the sanctuary is to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. So why do we come to the church? Why David wanted to be in the sanctuary? To gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. This we can speak only about this for hours. What does it mean, beauty of the Lord? You know, the word beauty is so vague for us today, but we may speak of beauty in different ways. Of course, we may speak of the beauty for eyes. We say this is a beautiful man, this is a beautiful woman, this is... beautiful, Scotland is beautiful, it is beautiful, of course. And this is the visual beauty. But then we may speak about the beauty for audio beauty. Yes, thank you for this. So when we listen to Chopin's, I don't know, yes, or some other nice Mozart's music or Haydn's music, we say it is beautiful. So there is some kind of correspondence between, so the beauty of hearing, it is another beauty. We may speak about the beauty of taste. You know how complex it is. We sometimes forget when we taste nice food and we say, oh, it is nice. It is such a complex process in our what was his name of this Hollywood actor who fell from the horse and then he was in the wheelchair? Reeves. Yes, Christopher Reeves. And he died, I think, last year or I don't know. And he during that he lost the taste. So for 7 years he didn't feel any, and he underwent a surgery in Canada to just regain his taste. And after the surgery, the nurse brought him. They blended his eyes and he brought him an orange. And after 7 years, for the first time, he could smell and taste orange. And then she brought coffee. This was the second. Yes. So there is beauty of taste. There is visual beauty. But then when David is speaking about this, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, the name of the Lord, you know, the whole great controversy, the name of the Lord, his character was put on shame in the universe. And just remember, the problem of sin is not problem of this earth primarily. Sin did not start here on this earth. It started in the universe. And it is going to end there. Why? That's why there are 1,000 years after that. And just remember, we are not Platonists. We do not believe like Catholics or other Protestants that after Jesus coming that we are going to go somewhere in the universe. No. This is influenced by Platonic. We believe that we are going to stay here on this earth. But during 1,000 years, we are going to participate in judgment. Why? Because sin started in the universe and it is going to end in the universe. When the name of God was put on shame, the people are asking questions whether he was ruling the universe in the right way. That's why when we come to the church, when we come to the sanctuary, we are invited to gaze upon the beauty of the character of God. So to be in the sanctuary of the Lord is primarily an experience. It is not a ritual. We are invited as soon as we enter here and we sit to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. And we believe, and you know, from all times, even Plato in his philosophy, he believed that there are two highest goods. It is good. We believe that by good he believed that it is God, and then beauty. Beauty is something that, so it is not only we may speak about that ideas are beautiful. Do you agree with me? Beautiful ideas, and so on and so on. So, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. And I think that there is so much room, and our minds are also bombarded by different wrong ideas about God. That's why we come to the church. Recently one church member told me, had there not been Sabbath, where I can refresh my mind, I would be lost in this world. So every Sabbath we come to refresh our minds and to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. So this is the first experience. That's why David says, why he was hiding in the caves of the Judean desert. And he says, there is one single request that I have for the Lord, that I dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. Why? To have triple experience. The first request for him was to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. But there is the second one. And this is in the last sentence of verse 4. It says, and to seek him in his temple. And in English here translation, whatever version of the Bible you have, but in the Hebrew, the word which is used here is the word bakar. Bakar. For you who know Hebrew. Bakar. Bakar. And bakar, you know, it means intellectual reflection, diligent seeking, detailed examination of evidences to determine the truth. Very important. So the first was Noam, the beauty, to reflect upon the beauty of the Lord. But then when we come to the church, we are also invited to use our intellectual, rational abilities. And to think, to inquire. Intellect, that this is what we are doing during the Sabbath school, I think. To diligence, to detail examination of evidences to determine the truth. Bakar. So you know, We God has given us the reason so that we may use the reason and if our reason is leading us to God, then human reason is fulfilling its purpose. If our reason is leading us away from God, then Apostle Paul says, then human reason becomes what? Fool. Foolish. In Romans chapter 1, when they thought that they are wise, they became. So you remember this myth of Narcissus? Maybe you. It is very good Greek myth. Narcissus was the most handsome young man ever, and all the girls who would see Narcissus, they would immediately fall in love with him, but he would never respond to any of these. And
advances.
Yeah, advances, yes, thank you. And then he was very unhappy because of that, because he couldn't find the girl who was beautiful enough for him, and he was wandering throughout the world looking for the girl who would be beautiful enough, until one day he wanted to drink some water from the fountain, and in the mirror of the water he finally discovered the person who is beautiful enough for him. And when he wanted to hug that person, the person disappeared in the water, and the rest of his life he was again wandering and being very unhappy. Why I'm telling you this myth? The love of Narcissus did not lead outside of himself, but it was leading him to himself. When our reason is not leading us to God, but is leading to us as the highest authority, then I think we are in trouble. And whose reason, you know, some people are, this is what we discussed yesterday, the historical critical method, are putting human reason above the word of God. And then we say, what reason? Yours? Mine? Is reason affected by sin? I think it is. You know, it is very, very difficult. So, but God invites us to use the reason. So the first experience in the sanctuary is, we are coming into the sanctuary to Noam, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord. But the second experience is Bakar, to include our intellectual abilities, our reason, to try to understand who God is, and to try to, of course, seek diligently. But this is not the last. There is a triple experience that David was talking about. In verse 5, it is very interesting, this psalm. It says, for in the day of trouble he will keep me safe. So he's speaking about the day of trouble. He may speak about his day of trouble, but generally in the Bible the day of trouble may also be the day of judgment. So that now he speaks of the day of trouble, and he says, in that day of trouble he will keep me safe in his, where? Where are we going to be safe in day of trouble? Under his, what is his tent? It is sanctuary. Oh, so David says, yes, I'm hiding from King Saul, but I have a single-minded experience, desire, and this to spend all the days of my life in the sanctuary of the Lord. Why? Because I was to gaze upon his beauty. I would like to reflect about God. And if I gaze upon his beauty, and you know, by looking at God, we are changing, transforming. And if I reflect, use my mind to think about God, when the day of trouble comes, when the judgment comes, we will be safe. Is he speaking here about justification, if you want? About, yes, look, he will hide me in the shelter of his tabernacle and set me high on a rock. So, in the day of trouble, we'll be on the rock. Because we have been spending. So, you know, the sanctuary is not some building there. It is an experience. It is the daily life. It is postmodern experience. You know, postmodernism emphasizes experience. They don't want some dogma, some. But this is, we can have experiential experience. It means we can live the life of the sanctuary. And the sanctuary is primarily in heaven, of course. So this is the triple experience. Let me read a few more verses. The key verse in this chiastic structure is verse 8. If you preach in your churches, it says, "My heart says of you, seek his face. Your face, Lord, I will seek." This is again Bakar. And then verse 13 says, "I am still confident of this. I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of living." I will see the goodness. When the day of trouble comes, then I will experience what? The goodness of the Lord. He will set me on the rock. Wait for the Lord, be strong, and take heart and wait for the Lord. Beautiful psalm. So, at the beginning of this day, I wanted just to tell you that to be in the sanctuary is, this is an experience, beautiful experience. So, when we speak about the sanctuary, we usually link sanctuary to the sin problem. It is very important what I'm now saying. So, and you know, in theology we call it hamartiology. It comes from the Greek word hamartia. So we believe, we generally speak about the sanctuary, we've seen how, we usually think about how human sins can be purified. But do you know that the sanctuary existed in the universe before sin appeared in the universe? Are you with me? How do we know this? Let's read Jeremiah 17:12. This is what I told to this lady who told me, sanctuary, I cannot stand it. What is the sanctuary? Even before sin problem appeared in the universe, there was a sanctuary. Jeremiah 17:12. The text says, "A glorious throne, exalted for how long?" Are you with me? From the beginning, in the place of our sanctuary. So what is the sanctuary here in Jeremiah? It is the throne of? It is the throne of God. And it existed from the beginning. It means it existed from always. And of course, the Garden of Eden was the first. I can come later to this point and to show you. Ezekiel 28:13. Let's read the second text. Ezekiel 28:13. The text says, you know that the text is talking about the Lucifer. The text says, "You were in Eden, the garden of God." What Eden? Is this earthly or heavenly Eden? Pardon me? It is heavenly Eden. Heavenly Eden. And then the text says, verse 14, "You were anointed as a guardian cherub, for so I ordained you. You were on the holy mount of God." What is this holy mount of God? So you see, heavenly Eden was the first sanctuary. The holy mountain of God, the throne of God, all this is synonymous with the sanctuary. And you will see a little bit later. Let's read Isaiah 14:12. Isaiah 14:12. The text says, "Now you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn. You have been cast down to the earth, you who once laid low the nations. You said in your heart, 'I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned on the mount of assembly, on the utmost high of the sacred mountain. So, do you get now the picture? The Mount of Assembly, the throne of God, heavenly Eden, the holy mountain, the heavenly sanctuary, it is the same thing. And the devil said, I will set my throne above. Why it was the Mountain of Assembly? Probably because the inhabitants of the whole universe would come there to worship God. That's why it is called the Mountain of Assembly. So one more time, let me repeat. Heavenly Eden, the Mount of Assembly, the throne of God. These are the same thing. The sanctuary. This is, how do we know? Let's look into the earthly sanctuary, which is the, you will see how many relations are there. I'm going to mention just a few. If you go to Genesis chapter 2, and the earthly sanctuary, the earthly Eden, which was planted in the east, is also the sanctuary. Why? How do we know this? Let me mention just a few points. Genesis chapter 2 verse 8 says, now the Lord God has planted a garden in the east. This is 2:8. But if we go to, just keep one hand here, and let's go to Ezekiel 47. So the Garden of Eden was planted in the east. Look at this. Ezekiel 47 verse 1. The text says, the man brought me back to the entrance of the temple, and I saw water coming out from under the threshold of the temple towards the east. Do you see the parallel here? The Garden of Eden was planted because the east was believed is the side from which God is coming. Then let me show you the second. The tree of life was in the midst of the Garden of Eden. In Genesis 2:9, the text says, Genesis 2:9, and the Lord God made all kinds of trees and so on and so on, pleasing to the eye and good for the, in the middle of the garden was the tree of life. And then in the tree of life, in the middle of the garden, in Exodus 25:8, who knows this verse by heart? Exodus 25:8. Make me a sanctuary so that I may dwell among you. The Hebrew term, in the midst of you. So in the Garden of Eden, in the midst of the Garden of Eden, was the tree of life. Now God says, make me a sanctuary so that I may dwell among. But the Hebrew is in the midst, in the middle, the midst of you. Then let's see another parallels. If we see the Garden of the third parallel, the Garden of Eden, God was walking around. It is mentioned only two times in the Old Testament. You know, in Genesis 3 verse 8, the text says, then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord as he was walking. Can you imagine God walking through the Garden of Eden? So this is in Genesis 3:8. But then in Deuteronomy 23:14, Deuteronomy 23:14, the text says, for the Lord your God moves about in your camp to protect you. So as God was, and you know, in the middle of the camp of Israelites was what? The sanctuary. And God was walking there. This is also interesting. And then the parallel number 4. I don't have time to go slowly. Deuteronomy 23:14. Many of you are writing. Just write down, and when you come home, you can check it. Then the fourth parallel. Four-headed river was coming from the Garden of Eden. Is it true? You remember this? This is in Genesis 2:10. Genesis 2:10, the text says, a river watering the garden flowed from the Eden. From there it was separated into four headwaters. Let's read Ezekiel 47 again. And this is verse 1. Still, the text says, the water was coming down from under the south side of the temple. And then verse 2. And then am I reading? Okay. So the water coming out under the threshold of the temple towards the east. The water was coming down from under the south side of the temple. Then he brought me out, yes, to the north gate and led me, and then the last to the water gate facing east, and the water was flowing from the south side. So, and this river is developed as in the Garden of Eden. There was a four-headed river. The same is in the sanctuary. And I think in the book of Revelation, you have Revelation 22:1. You have the same thing. Just look at this. Revelation 22:1. The text says, "Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, flowing from the throne of God," and so on and so on. So the river flowing from the Garden of Eden. Then the parallel number 5 between the Garden of Eden and the sanctuary. In chapter 2, verse 12 of Genesis, we find precious metals mentioned there, gold, onyx, and so on and so on. Do you know that these same precious metals are mentioned in relation to the high priest? Yes. Then let me mention another interesting parallel between the Garden of Eden and the sanctuary. We have the earth, the whole earth. Then in the middle of the earth we have the Garden of Eden. And then in the midst of that Garden of Eden we have the Tree of Life. So in the same way we have the camp of the Israelites. Then we have the sanctuary. And then we have the Holy of Holies. Very also interesting. There are many other parallels that we can find. So let me summarize this first part of my presentation. When we go into the Bible, we usually link the sanctuary doctrine with the problem of human sin. This is not the case in the Bible. In the Bible, when the Bible, the Old Testament, speaks about the sanctuary, it speaks about the heavenly throne, which existed from the beginning. It is the Mount of Assembly. It is the heavenly Eden. This is the place where all inhabitants from all the universe would come to worship God. So, and there is one important sentence. All you who are writing, write it down, please. Before hamartiology, the heavenly sanctuary was place of doxology. So hamartiology is the science of sin, and doxology, do you know what is doxology? Praise. So before, the sanctuary was the place of engaged into solving the problem of human sin. It was the place where all inhabitants of the universe would come to praise God. Okay, then some people say, but in Revelation chapter 21 verse 22, John says, "I have not seen the temple." You know, there is this text. Revelation 21:22. "I have not seen the temple." And they say the temple is not going to exist in the new earth. But the fact that he did not see the temple doesn't mean much, because he himself says earlier, just in chapter 21 verse 2, "I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from the heaven and verse 3, "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying," from the throne, now the dwelling of God. And what is the dwelling of God? This is the sanctuary. Yes. Is with man. You know, in Exodus 25:8, "Make me a sanctuary so that I may dwell among," in the midst of you. Now it is here. God is in the midst of his people. And you know, the whole New Jerusalem has the form of cube, as had the earthly sanctuary, of a cube shape. And of course, when Jesus speaks about the sanctuary in John chapter 14, he speaks of my Father's house. And I would just tell you that sanctuary is the way of life. It is the constant, intimate fellowship with the Heavenly Father. Spiritually, we can live the life of the sanctuary. Be in the presence of God. on a daily basis, to have an experience, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, to seek, to use our intellectual abilities, to understand who God is, and at the end, if we do this, if we gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, if we involve our reason to understand who God is, when the day of trouble comes, He will put us on the rock, and we will be safe, and we will experience the goodness of the Lord. I'll stop here now. It is to the president now what we are going before we get into the second. Are we going to have questions or? But there are no much here, but maybe there are some questions. Yes.
Okay, just any questions or clarification. But also, we will take just a 2-minute break again and go out for some refreshments out there and come back in. But any immediate questions on this part?
Yes.
You just referring to the most holy place, or because if you look at the holy and the most holy place, it's not a cube, but
yeah, there
what
is,
do you mean?
The sanctuary is the cube form. If you know, the measurement is very precise in the Old Testament.
Yes.
And the same form has the New Jerusalem. This is interesting. I'm not specialist for this,
but I'm now just relying on the information of the good Old Testament scholars.
Is that only the most holy place?
I think it is the whole. I think it is the whole sanctuary.
Because the whole sanctuary, it wasn't a cube.
Yeah, I don't know. I have to check this. I really have to check it.
Okay.
But there is something there. I'm positive. Maybe you can check also. Maybe it is. I don't think it is only the most holy place. Yeah.
Okay, let's go for refreshments, get drinks, and come back.
And then we'll go to some real stuff.
Yep.